to turn to Genesis chapter 37 this morning. Yes, Genesis. We're taking a little break from Luke here through the spring, rest of the spring and the summer. And we're going to jump into a new series today called God's Purpose in the Pit. And we're going to look at the life of Joseph over the next several weeks and how God was with him and worked through him, through various ups and downs of his life and various pits that he had to walk through, and then see how that maybe applies to us as we're walking with the Lord and how he has a purpose in our lives and all the things that we have to go through as well. And so I hope this is going to be helpful to you and encouraging to you over the next several weeks. And so we're going to kick off today with the first story here in the life of Joseph, Genesis 37, verses 1 through 11 this morning, looking at the pit of folly. Have you ever noticed how our brains are really cruel to us at times? Like how they just kind of naturally log our worst, most traumatic, most like horrible events. They just log right there in long-term memory, so you can just pull those babies back out and just relive those over and over again. Anybody else got this going on? Anybody else have like a top 10 most embarrassing moments list just kind of stored away there in your head, just so they can pull it out? Like, I was there the first time. I don't need this again, right? Like, I got it. But somehow they just kind of keep coming up. I was thinking about this week. It was Spirit Week, 1992, and sixth grade Micah came strolling into school that morning, fully decked out for Spirit Week in my beach bum attire. And I had the tank top, I was in swim trunks, flip-flops, I think there was even like a pool floaty thing involved, and I just come like walking so confident right into that gym first thing in the morning, whole school's in there, and as I walk in, I realize it is black and gold day. Our school colors, not beach bum day, and I had to wear that the rest of the day with all my classmates. It was horrible, and to this day, I still refuse to wear tank tops in the summer. That's just scarred me for life. And so, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know what your moments are, but like maybe it was like not making the sports team or getting cut. Maybe it was not making the school play or being on that list on the door of the choir teacher's room or whatever the thing was. Maybe it was the boy or girl that you really liked, and when you asked them out, then they just shot you down. Maybe it was, you know, getting up to give that speech in front of the entire class, only to find out that your fly was open. It's a zipper on jeans and pants. I know some of y'all, like younger people, like they don't have them on joggers and leggings. Like they're only on like real pants, and so some of y'all have not had that experience. But this is these are kind of things that happen to us, and we just kind of get logged in there, right? And sometimes I look back on embarrassing, or look back at my life, and there were things I wasn't even embarrassed about at the time, right? But now looking back, I'm like, that was ridiculous, right? The way I talked to that person, the stance I took on that argument, what I wore in that picture, like that was just embarrassing, even though I didn't know it at the moment. Just foolish, embarrassing things that happen. But you know what's worse, I think, than even that top 10 list of embarrassing moments? I think most of us probably have this list as well, is that top 10 sin list, right? Those things that you've done in your past that, again, are just kind of lodged there and get stuck in your brain, and you have to live with that list. The moments where folly went beyond embarrassing to shameful, guilt-ridden acts or thoughts, or maybe you didn't even see it or feel it at the moment. You didn't think it was wrong or sinful then, but now looking back, you're like, man, that was rough. That top 10 sin list, it sticks in our brain and it hangs over us like a dark cloud in our lives sometimes, right? And we feel like these sins of our past have somehow ruined our future. That these are these things that we can't ever go back and undo, and now we have to live with the consequences of them and the fallout of them, and they kind of just hang as this dark cloud that blocks the grace and the goodness of God in our lives. But thankfully, as we look into God's word, we find out that's not actually how it works at all. That nothing we can do or have done can block the grace of God from working in our lives. Even in light of our folly, even in light of our sin, even in light of whatever it is we've done or had done to us, it cannot block God's grace and God's favor from working in and through our lives, even today. And that's what we're going to look at as we look at this first story in the life of Joseph. And I want us to see this truth. I want us to hold on to this and lodge this deeper in our brains than all those lists that we have. That we can worship God for his favor in our folly. That in spite of whatever we've done, whatever we've walked in, that we can worship God because he can still bring favor, he can still bring grace, even in our folly. Now, before we dive into the life of Joseph here in Genesis 37, I think it's important that we have a background of how we got here, right? And which is hard to do because we're 37 chapters in to Genesis at this point. But I'm going to try to give you a background here. I'm going to give you a synopsis of Genesis in 2 minutes. All right, are you ready for this? Like, lock in here for a second, okay? So Genesis starts with creation of the world, right? God comes and he creates everything, and he makes it perfect, and he calls it good. And in that creation, he creates the first man and woman, Adam and Eve, who are made perfect in his image for a relationship with him. But they shortly after that decide to disobey God and to rebel against him and his word, and they bring sin into the world, corrupting themselves and all of mankind from that point forward. Because of that sin, evil continues to grow throughout the earth, spreading and coming out of control till it gets so bad that God says, that's it, I'm done. I'm going to wipe all the sin off the face of the earth. I'm going to choose one man, one family by which I will save mankind and keep things going. And he chose Noah and his family. He saved them from a worldwide flood that wiped out everyone else and all of the sin. He brings them safely through, and he calls them to follow him and to worship him as their God. They do that, and then he tells them, hey, go multiply and fill the earth again. And so they start to do that, and they start to spread, they start to create these families, but instead of spreading out across the globe like God said, they decide, hey, let's just all stay together. And we'll live together in this one city, and we'll make ourselves great, and we'll build this giant tower up to God and make ourselves equal to him, and we'll bring heaven down to us. And God says, that's not what I told you to do. And so he changes all of their languages and forces them to spread out again across the face of the earth. As the family start to spread out again, he's like, all right, I need somebody to take forward my name and worship me. And so he chooses again one man named Abraham, and he calls him to himself. And he says, hey, I want you to be my person. I want you to be I'm going to start a family with you. And he gives him three promises. Right? You're going to have descendants as numerous as the stars, that you are going to have a special land in which you will get to live and worship me, and I will be with you, and your family, this nation that's going to come from you, will bless all the other nations of the world. From that promise, Abraham has a singular son named Isaac, and Isaac is the son of promise who will carry on God's family name and carry on the promises that he gave to Abraham. Isaac, in turn, has two sons, twin sons, Esau and Jacob. God chooses Jacob, the younger, to be the one who carries on the family name and to carry on these promises of God, and he continues to do that, and that's where we pick up in Genesis chapter 37. Jacob now has his own kids, and this story of the life of Joseph is actually the story of the descendants of Jacob, as we're going to see here in verse 37. Joseph is just kind of the one that gets highlighted in the midst of these 12 sons of Jacob. So let's pick it up there in Genesis 37, verse 1. It says, Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojournings in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. Now, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream that I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed another dream, and he told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. So what I want to show you here in this opening story of Joseph's life is folly. Folly and God's favor in that folly. And we're going to look at it in three pieces this morning. The first is the folly of Jacob. The folly of Jacob was favoritism. Favoritism. And it starts off where it says that it talks about Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. All right, so right off the bat, we get a reference here that, yes, Jacob had actually not just two wives, he had four wives, okay? And before you even ask, yes, polygamy is a sin. It is not God's design. We do not practice that. But there is a story about how we got here with Jacob's family, okay? So let me kind of tell you that story real quickly as well. Way back when, Jacob goes out and he falls in love with Rachel, this daughter of Laban, and he agrees to work for Laban for 7 years in order to marry Rachel. Laban agrees, and so he works for 7 years, but on the wedding night, instead of sending Rachel in to marry him, Laban tricks Jacob, and he sends in Leah instead, her sister, the older sister. And when Jacob finally realizes what's happened, it's too late, they're already married, and he says, "Sorry, we always marry the older first, and so Leah had to get married first, so that's the one you got." And Jacob's like, "Well, I want to marry Rachel. She's the one I love." And he's like, "Hey, no problem. Work for another 7 years for me, and I will let you marry Rachel." And so then he said, "Okay, I'll do that." And so now he has two wives, Leah and Rachel, who are sisters. Problem is, he loved Rachel more, right? Which then creates this tension, this constant tension among the sisters where they're competing for his attention and for his love. And so they get into this baby-making war between the sisters, okay? Problem with that is Rachel actually can't conceive. And so Leah's just popping out the kids and getting all the attention from Jacob. And so Rachel, not to be outdone by older sister Leah, gives her servant Bilhah to Jacob as a third wife so that she can have kids in her stead, right? So she starts having kids. Well, Leah isn't going to be having that from little sis, and so she gives Jacob her servant as well, Zilpah, to be his fourth wife and to also bear him children on her behalf, okay? So now we got all these kids coming, and then finally at the end, Rachel actually is blessed by God, and she gets to conceive as well, bearing two children at the end, which gives him 12 sons. So this is the incredibly messy, sinful family tree of Jacob. All right, four wives, 12 sons in that arrangement. And that's going to play a whole lot into the life and the story of Joseph as we start to walk through this. But this whole chain reaction of sin and struggle was started with Jacob's favoritism of Rachel. But it didn't stop there. As we see here in this story, it says that Israel, which is another name for Jacob, by the way, loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was the son of his old age, aka the firstborn son of Rachel, his favorite wife. So now Joseph becomes his favorite son. And to make sure everyone knew it, he made him a robe of many colors. Now, despite what you may have seen on the stage or on the TV, we don't know this was actually a robe of many colors, okay? What it really means is it was a fancy robe. It was like some extravagant robe, probably like what royalty would have worn back then, right? So the equivalent today is like Jacob gave Joseph a Bentley while all the other kids were driving beaters, okay? Like he had like the primo thing and everybody else has just got the normal stuff, right? And so there was no doubt that Jacob loved Joseph the most. But to be fair to Jacob a little bit, is he learned this favoritism from his own parents. If we go back to Isaac and Rebekah's story, they each had their own favorite son as well. Isaac loved Esau, the older brother, more. Rebekah loved Jacob, the younger brother, more. And so this was modeled for him. He picked this up, and this is oftentimes the case. It's a generational sin of folly. We see this in families all the time. The sins of the parents oftentimes get passed on to the kids. And they become repeated in this cycle in our families. In this case, it was favoritism. To exasperate the whole situation even further, Joseph was given special treatment and privilege by Jacob. It says here that he was a boy with his brothers. Again, the translation there is a little hard. It doesn't mean boy as in like young. It means boy as in like servant boy, right? All the other brothers were out in the field tending the flocks. They were out there having to stay overnight, do the hard work. Joseph was chosen by Jacob to be his special servant, which means he got to stay back in the tent and hang out with dad all day and just do the special errands and didn't have to go out and work in the fields with the rest of the brothers. Right? We see this even more clearly in verse 13 that we're going to get to next week when Jacob has to send him out to go check on the brothers that are in the fields because he wasn't out there. He's back at tent with dad. Right? So he gets a special role, the special privilege with Jacob, and he became dad's little informant. Right? So he would go out and check on the brothers and then bring back the reports, which I'm sure went over really well with the big brothers. Okay? Any of you have siblings, you know what I'm talking about, right? So it says, because of all this, they hated him. The brothers hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. They couldn't even stand to talk to the kid. He had become the enemy, the thorn in their side, the outcast, because of Jacob's favoritism. Now, when we talk about favoritism, we've all seen this. We've all experienced this in various ways. Maybe it was at school. Maybe it's at work. Maybe it's in your own family or on the team or, you know, in the friend group or whatever it is. And it always produces the same outcome. No matter where it's at, no matter how it goes, it always produces the same outcome. Division. Favoritism always creates this us versus them situation. Just like it did here in Jacob's family. So the first thing we need to see here in this is just a little lesson on the side. If you sow favoritism, you will reap factions and fighting. If you sow favoritism, you will reap factions and fighting. And that's exactly what we see here in Jacob's family. But he wasn't the only one who has folly in this story. The next we see here, this is the folly of Joseph. And folly of Joseph, I'm going to call loose lips. And we see all throughout this passage, Joseph is speaking. He's constantly talking. And it gets him into trouble. Right? First it says he brought a bad report back to dad about his brothers. Now it doesn't tell us bad how. Right? Was he reporting on some bad behavior of his brothers? Maybe. Or was it a bad report because he was just giving some petty complaints to dad that weren't really a big deal? Or was it possibly even untrue accusations to get back at brothers who were so mean to him? We don't know for sure, but the report was bad. We do know this. Whatever he reported, it did not help the family dynamics that were already at play. It just exasperates the whole thing. If he wasn't outright sinful in what he said, at a minimum, he was foolish. he lacked wisdom in how and what he was saying to his father. And so a lesson here, I think, for us is that sometimes everything we can say, we still shouldn't say. In our house, we have three girls, which means there's lots of talking. And we've taught them throughout the years that there's three questions that we should ask before we speak in order to guard our tongue. All right, now these aren't foolproof. There are situations that are outside of this. But in general, three questions to guard our tongue and to be careful that we're speaking when and how we should. Number one, is it kind? Number two, is it true? Number three, is it necessary? Is it kind? Is it true? Is it necessary? And if I can't say yes to all three of those, there's a good chance I probably shouldn't say it. Again, there are exceptions to the rule, but in general, this is a way for us to guard our tongue in the way that we speak to one another. Because sometimes it's just foolish to speak, and it's better to leave some things unsaid. And that goes for adults just as much as it does for kids. So Joseph here, he gives the bad report, and then it says he has a dream. We're going to call this dream number one, okay? Now, a little synopsis here for a second. Dreams are a major theme in the life of Joseph. We're going to see dreams pop up a lot throughout this study, okay? And these first two, though, are the only two dreams of Joseph. These only two dreams that come from him. And while these dreams are not specifically said to be from God or even interpreted by God, the remainder of the story will prove out that they were indeed from God. In fact, that will be true of all the dreams that we see throughout the life of Joseph. It's always God speaking in some way in that situation. That doesn't mean, by the way, that every dream you have is God speaking to you, okay? This is like two dreams in the entire lifetime of Joseph, all right? So let's not like count every time it was just bad pizza that you had last night, okay? So like, let's not go off the deep end here. But there is occasionally where God speaks, and we're going to see that through here. And this, and what's more important about these first two dreams is that it establishes God as the main character of the story. It's the life of Joseph, but he's not the main character. By the way, you have a life, right? Like, it's your life, but you hope you've figured out by now, like, you're not the main character of your life. God is. Same is true for Joseph. He's showing that he is the one who is sovereign over everything, and that he's working behind the scenes to do all these things in Joseph's life and in Jacob's family and in the world. And he reveals it to Joseph through these dreams. And they set the stage for the fact that God has a purpose in every single thing that happens in our lives. And so Joseph has this dream, and he goes to his brothers, and it says he said to them, hey, hear this dream. Now, Joseph here in his foolish immaturity can't help but tell his big brothers about this dream, right? He's so jazzed. He's so excited about it. It just comes kind of bursting out of him. He says, hey, listen to this dream. You're all going to bow down to me. Isn't that great? And they're like, really? Little brat, you think so? You think that's how it's going to go? We'll just see, right? Good luck with that. You see, in this situation, I think Joseph, he didn't think before he spoke. He didn't think about how his already envious, hateful brothers were going to receive this message from him. Plus, God didn't interpret the dream at this point. He didn't validate the dream in any way. So at this point, it's just Joseph just spouting off, right? Nobody knows anything else. In fact, I think it's also worth noting that God didn't actually tell Joseph to tell anybody about this dream. Like, maybe this was just for him for now. Maybe he wasn't supposed to tell anybody yet. But he does. And we're like, hey, bro, read the room. Right? Not helping. And again, it's just another point, like, you don't have to say everything that you think. Some of us need to hear that this morning. You don't have to say everything that you think. even if it's right or true or good. So then he goes and he dreams another dream, right? So we'll call this dream number two. But it's actually the same dream as the first dream, right? It's different imagery, but the same message coming through. The whole family is going to bow down to Joseph. And the fact that it's repeated a second time in a second dream means that God has established it as certain. When God repeats something like this, he's telling you like, hey, this is me, this is my plan, this is the way it's going to happen. So Joseph goes and he says, hey guys, I've dreamed another dream. They're like, hey, please tell us, because it went so well the first time. Let us hear the second dream. But this time, interestingly, notice it escalates even more. Because he tells the dream, and this time his father, who loved him so much, his favorite son, but his father rebuked him for what he said. But also, he kept the saying in mind. So there's this interesting juxtaposition here, right? Jacob didn't necessarily disagree with the dream. He didn't necessarily dismiss the dream as wrong or unimportant. But he does rebuke Joseph's delivery of the dream as foolish again. He shouldn't have shared it. At least not like that. That's what we're getting here. And because he shared these dreams, he's just been talking and talking and talking, it says they hated him even more and that they were jealous of him. This is the fruit of his loose lips. Loose lips lead to lousy relationships. Loose lips lead to lousy relationships. Even if what you're saying is true, even if what you're saying is from God, even if you are certain that you are right, how and when you say it matters. How you communicate impacts the message that you're trying to give. As a father, I can and should address misbehavior in my kids. That is my job. That is my responsibility given to me by the Lord. I need to do that. But if I do it in a sinful, angry way, it cheapens the message that I'm trying to send. And some or all of the impact may be lost because of how I wrongly communicated it. Not because of what I said was wrong, but because of how I communicated it was wrong. And the same goes for all of our communication. We have to beware of the folly of loose lips. For a long time here at Harvest, we've had a saying, if you are wrong in the way you are right, you are wrong even if you're right. If you're wrong in the way that you're right, in the way that you're communicating, then the message is going to come off wrong even if you're right about what you're saying. Because how we communicate, when we communicate, matters. So we need to be careful of that folly in our lives. But there's one more example of folly here in this book, in this story as well, and that's the folly of the brothers. The folly of the brothers is hatred and jealousy. We see the hatred of Joseph's brothers comes out loud and clear in this passage. Four times it says they hated him or were jealous of him, right? Four times. But why they hated him is actually even more instructive than the fact that they hated him. They hated him because of who his mom was, because of this identity that he was born into, right? They hated him because of how his dad treated him, the privilege that he was given. They hated him because of his birth order, because he was lower than them, and they despised that he kept getting all the attention, and they hated him because of his attitude, this immature arrogance that just kind of comes with the life stage of a 17-year-old. For the most part, they hated him for things that he could not control or had no say in. But the last line really nails it down. It says his brothers were jealous of him. They hated him because they resented what he had that they didn't. His status, his advantage, his position, his calling from God. They were jealous of the attention and favor and love that he was receiving from the Father. They were jealous because of comparison. And their jealousy fueled their hatred. And so their response to all of this further divides the family because they chose fury over forgiveness. Was Jacob wrong? Yes. Was Joseph wrong in some of his things? Yeah, I think so. But they escalated it and made it worse because they chose fury instead of forgiveness. And again, I think if we're being honest this morning, I think we've all been there. Right? Someone else is foolish toward us or sinful towards us, sins against us, and we just blow up at them. Right? We can't handle the offense. We can't handle the injustice. And so we respond in fury, what even feels like justified fury, vindicated fury. But when we do that, we actually just continue the line of folly that we're protesting against. When we respond to sin with sin, we're just continuing to follow them down this path of folly. When we choose fury over forgiveness, we get pulled into the spiral of sin. Instead, God says, hey, why don't you let me handle that? How about I take that? You just follow me. You just follow me in love and grace and forgiveness, and I'll take care of that, right? Let me deal with the folly rather than you joining in to add more. And so we see in this passage that God calls me out of my folly and into his favor. This is not what he has for us. He calls us out of the folly and sin of our lives and into the favor of Christ. And to that point, I want to spend the rest of our time, just a couple minutes here at the end, to look at two things. The first is the Christ connection in this story. We're going to do this throughout the life of Joseph because Joseph is what we call a type of Christ in the Old Testament. Meaning that as we walk through his life, we're going to see all these different ways that Joseph is a picture of Jesus. He is a foreshadow, a type of Jesus in the Old Testament that points us to who Jesus will be one day when he comes. And this is important for us to see, I think, as New Testament believers, because we learn from this that God has always been the same. Right? Old Testament, New Testament, doesn't matter. He is the same. He's been working to reveal himself, his character, in the same ways throughout all of human history. This is why the Old Testament is still relevant to us today as believers, just as much as the New Testament. Because it all points to and shows us Jesus, who he is, and how we can follow him. So in this first story, at the outset here, we see several pictures of Jesus show up in the life of Joseph. First, Joseph was loved and chosen by his father, but hated by his brothers. He was hated for his God-given identity and position. Likewise, Jesus was loved by the Father and hated by his fellow Jewish brothers and sisters that he came to minister to. Also, Joseph was prophesied to be the first among his brothers and to reign over them, as we see here with the dreams. Jesus also was prophesied to come as the first among many brothers who would be brought to God and to rule over them as the Messiah King for all of eternity. Joseph was hated and despised by those jealous of his position with the Father. Jesus also was hated and despised by the religious elite of the day because of his position with God, one that they could never earn or attain for themselves. And lastly, Joseph was hated by those that he was called ultimately to save. Likewise, Jesus was hated and ultimately killed for those that he came to save as well. And as we look at these pictures of Joseph and Jesus, all these things are true of both of them, but they're also true of those who will follow Jesus. I hope you understand this morning that as a Christian, as a disciple of Christ, as members of his body, when you signed up to follow Jesus, you signed up for all of this. Just like Jesus was mistreated and despised and hated, we as his followers will experience the same thing for his namesake. If we're truly living out the gospel, if we are truly following him, we should expect no less hatred than our Savior himself endured. He said to his disciples, "They hated me, so they're going to hate you too." That's what Jesus said. But knowing that, and knowing that that's coming in various forms and fashions in our life, we don't have to respond to this hatred with more folly. We don't have to add our sin to their sin. Because we can know that even though we might experience this ridicule and hatred and this type of issues, we also know that we get to experience the favor of our God. And his favor far outweighs the folly and hatred and jealousy that we have to endure or walk in or even put out there ourselves at times. His favor and his grace is greater. You know, I was thinking about this week. Last week was Easter, obviously, and I'm so proud of how many of you invited friends and family and brought people to Good Friday service, Easter. It was so cool to see so many new people, and a lot of them, when I talked to them, they said that they were invited by one of you. But I also know that many of you invited people who didn't show, right? Or who ghosted you when you sent them something. Or maybe even just flat out rejected you and had some words for you because they weren't interested. I also know some of you at your family gatherings last week for Easter that you had to experience ridicule or sarcastic comments or condescending remarks about your faith and about the fact that you follow and believe in Jesus. Because the other people, they just don't get it. So in small ways and in big ways, you have endured the folly and hate for the name of Jesus. Have we went to a cross? No, none of us have done that. Have we been in chains and in jailed and prison? I don't think so. But it doesn't mean that we don't still experience the ridicule and the hatred for Jesus' name. But I want you to know today that in whatever way you might have experienced that or are experiencing that in your relationships right now, that whatever you're feeling from those other people, your Father in heaven is looking down with pleasure and favor on the fact that you are following him and that you're standing for the name of Jesus. He loves you, and he will bring good out of whatever it is you have to walk through for his name's sake. He is sovereign over all of it, and he has a plan and a purpose for it in your life. We can trust in his faithfulness. The last thing I want to touch on this morning is the gospel application. We don't ever want to just read Old Testament stories as some moral lesson for us. We want to look at how does this relate to the gospel and how do I walk with Jesus because of what I've learned today. And as we think about the gospel application, I want us to first pause and recognize God's sovereign hand in the midst of a very foolish and messed up family. Right? You have Jacob, who was foolish in his favoritism, and yet he was the one that was chosen by God to lead the family of faith into the next generation. You have Joseph, who was foolish in his speech and yet used by God to fulfill his plan and to show his glory to not just Jacob and his family, but to the whole nation of Egypt, we'll see down the road. Sorry, spoiler alert. And the brothers were foolish in their hatred and in their jealousy, and yet they were still called to be the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. These were messed up people. And yet God still had a purpose and a plan to use them in spite of their folly. In spite of their mistakes, in spite of their failures, their foolishness could not thwart his covenant. Their flaws could not mess up his plan. Their failures, no matter how big or how severe or how recurring, could not quench his sovereign grace towards them. And that means neither can we. No matter what foolish things we have done or said or even thought, we need to understand this morning that God is greater. No matter what sin is on our record, God is greater. No matter how many times we have returned to our foolish and sinful ways, God is greater. He is sovereign over all of our folly, and he will use it to bring his favor in our lives if we will just embrace Jesus, if we will just embrace the gospel, because Jesus' purpose was to come and keep the covenant promises of God and fulfill his sovereign plan for those who love and are called according to his name. That's what the gospel is all about, friends. We talk about it all the time here at Harvest because this is the center of everything. That yes, we are sinners. Yes, we have folly. Yes, we have screwed up royally. We have disobeyed the God of the universe, and we deserve nothing but punishment and wrath from him. And yet, out of his love and his grace towards us, he sent his only son, Jesus, to come, be born as a man, live a perfect and sinless life, and then go to the cross and take all of our folly, all of our sin, all of our shame upon himself. He died in our place to pay our debt, went into the grave, and then rose 3 days later, proving that he was God, and offering us a chance to be saved from all of it. When we turn to Jesus in faith, his grace turns our folly into God's favor. We don't have to live in hatred or jealousy over what we don't have or what we should have had or what happened to us in the past or how we were slighted by this person or hurt by that person. We just have to come to Jesus and trust him that he will use all of it for his glory and for our good. And when we truly get that, when that truly finally clicks in our hearts and in our brains, then we can truly embrace the sovereign plan of God for our lives. And when we trust him like that with our whole lives, there is only one response that we can have, and that is worship. Worship. Stand in awe of him and worship him for his perfect and profound grace in our lives. When we finally see his perfect hand, we worship. We worship God for his favor in our folly. Remember that top 10 sin list that we talked about at the beginning? You're like, yeah, Mike, I'm actually trying to forget that. Thanks for bringing that up again. Well, here's the great news about the gospel. The great thing about Jesus is you don't have to forget it. You don't need to forget all those things that you've done and all the things that you've said. You don't have to forget it. You just have to see it through his eyes and through his plan. You see, when Jesus looks at that list of yours, he doesn't just see a list of our sins and our failures and our folly. He sees a list of opportunity. He sees a chance to show us his favor in spite of who we are. He sees a chance for us to surrender all of it to him and trust him and trust his grace is greater than our list. He sees a chance to expand our worship so that we can experience his favor and his grace well beyond the days of our folly. God sees that list not as a condemning thing above you. He sees it as a chance for you to worship him and be set free from all of it as he uses it for his glory. Worship him for his favor in our folly.